Okay, so we're back. The battery is still working, I see. And so this is part three of the thing that was never introduced in part one. Actually, I'll probably go back and edit the beginning of part one and put a little introduction on it. You really should. I always forget to do that. So where we were just at this podcast, screencast, and beyond slide. And I think we basically covered the concept. I'm just wondering, is there more coffee back there? Oh, I will use this water then. See, it did pay off after all. And is it flavored? It's Naya flavored. That's a joke. What I was trying to get at with this slide and with the various other slides. And so that wraps us up. I love doing that to people. the idea of the user-generated content. And before the break, I began talking about blogs and the use of blogs. And what I'm trying to capture with this slide is that it goes way beyond blogs. And so we've got podcasting, for example, and this is what I'm doing right here, right, is podcasting. And it's been around a little more than a year, but there's been this explosion of creativity in the audio sphere. And again, it's because the tools have been put into people's hands that make it very simple and effective to do it. This tool that I'm using here, which you've seen already a few times, is Audacity. How many of you are familiar with Audacity? 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe half of you?
He's a philosopher.
Woohoo!
Training.
We like philosophy. You can come sit in the front here. Of course, being the philosopher, I sit in the back of the room there carping things. Epistemological relativism. Poppycock. He's obviously not Red Russell. Sorry, I couldn't resist. I should have said Whitehead or Russell. Anyhow. Boy, that created some Audacity. The neat thing about this program is that it's free and open source. So it puts into the hands of anybody the capacity to produce audio content. And you can do pretty much everything you want with this program in the realm of audio recording. For me, because you know I don't have hundreds of dollars to spend on audio recording software, for me, the beginning of audio recording came when I discovered Audacity. And that was the turning point for me. And I think that's the turning point for a lot of people. So we'll let that do its thing in the background. Flickr, you've probably heard of, which, as I mentioned before the break, is a place where people can store their images. And people store hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of images. Flickr is probably the world's largest repository of bad photography in the world. I couldn't resist that. There are some really good things on Flickr. But if you really like this stuff, if you've ever seen a site called DeviantArt, all one word, which predates Flickr, and fabulous, fabulous site. It's unfortunately, it's not fast. Like when you load it, it's not as fast as it could be, but it's very popular, hugely popular site, probably more popular than Flickr. It doesn't get the press that Flickr does, but it's certainly widely used. And again, there are hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of photographs and other bits of artwork on the site. You talk about your cultural artifacts, right? Here's an entire cultural community that has sprung up, has created this whole wealth of artifacts, and it goes almost completely unnoticed by the larger outside culture. I find that fascinating.
What's the name?
DeviantArt. It's all one word.
And it's like anybody who can put their stuff there.
This is why I use Firefox rather than Internet Explorer, because you don't need to mess around with URLs. There it is right there. And look, I mean, look at the stuff. I mean, this is high quality material. This is not, you know, just some kid toying with things. We're getting high quality artifacts here.
Maybe not that one.
Goes with a theme.
Did I see 15 million? 15 million images at the beginning?
You may well have. 15,118. Look at his counting up.
That's
692, 693.
That's a life,
so.
Direct life.
And I've got a few things in here, if I remember. And. See, remember this identity. If I had my same identity here as I had in my learning environment or on Flickr or whatever, you know, I wouldn't have to remember passwords, and I might get it.
But the future is that, Stephen.
Oh, it's totally, yeah. And
these are yours?
No. These are not mine. Mine are somewhere. I'm just trying to remember where. I have 21 new messages. I haven't been here for a while. I don't have very many here because mostly I put my stuff on my own website. I've got hundreds and hundreds of photos on my own website because I've got lots of space. So, but if I didn't have that space, I'd have hundreds and hundreds of photos here or on Flickr or somewhere. I mean, I can do that. I don't need to buy a major server in order to have this incredible resource. Where are mine? Profile. Let's try profile. Hope I don't have anything bad in here. avatar, deviation management.
But that's good to know that it exists.
Yeah. I wonder where mine are. Like I said, identity. I just haven't been here recently, and they've changed where things are. Oops. That's Google. Any features?
Going into a mall, you go to a mall, you know exactly where it is, and then you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. You go to the rest.
Oh, well, I don't know where they are, but it doesn't matter. You don't need to see my pictures. Mm-hmm. Another site, and this one I was actually involved in the creation of ourmedia.org. And so.
Our media.
And again, this is a place where people can upload their images, their text, their videos, and it's unlimited uploading.
Oh, really?
And you can upload whatever you want. And then they feature things. And it's not just images, it's video and everything. And they change them. So, and as I say, I actually helped build this, so I'm kind of proud of it.
Accessible to all.
Wikipedia is yet again another type of user-generated content, and this is collaborative content. Again, let me ask, how many of you are familiar with Wikipedia? Rock and roll. Everyone in the room, pretty well. We like to see that. That's good. And Wikipedia is the readers of an encyclopedia replacing the need for the encyclopedia. Oops.
With one of their own.
Encyclopedia Britannica doesn't approve.
Well, of course they don't approve.
Well, the
other one. Oh, sorry. I thought this was Rice University, not Eric Rice, but. Yeah, 10-minute podcast, you need to learn how to do it, piece of cake. The information's there on the internet. So you don't need to take special courses, go into training classes or anything like that. All you need is free, simple technology, a little bit of guidance that you can find on websites like this. And the neat thing is, because you always hear, and I'm sure you guys hear this all the time, you know, if you don't pay people, or if you don't reward them for being creative, then people won't do it. Well, nobody pays. Mm-hmm. Nobody paid for those 15 million images in DeviantArt. Nobody pays for the millions of images in Flickr. Nobody paid this guy to put up this How to Create a 10-Minute Podcast. The evidence, from my perspective, is overwhelming that given the chance, people will create, and they will do it for free, and indeed they will even pay money for the privilege of being able to create. And so the economics are quite backwards from what, or quite opposite from what is typically assumed. You don't need to pay people to create. You just need to give them the space to do so and the capacity to do so, and then you can't stop them. And the thesis I use to explain this, well, it doesn't really explain this, but it brings it home. I call it the butterfly thesis. And what the butterfly thesis is, you go driving around, especially in country roads, but also even in the city, you look at the houses, and every once in a while, fairly frequently actually, you see those wooden butterflies on the front of the house, right? And the question is, why did people put those butterflies on their house? Were they paid to do so? No. Obviously not. In fact, they probably had to go out and buy the butterflies. Right? Do they get some sort of reward for doing this? Is there a royalty, or whatever? No, there's no incentive, no financial or other incentive to putting butterflies on your house, except you want your house to look nice. And you want people to appreciate the butterflies when they drive by. And that, in my view, applies to creativity generally. And indeed, I would even, again, I'm talking to a museum community here, I would bet, and you can correct me if I'm right or wrong, that a significant percentage, if not the majority, of the things that you look at, that you work with, that you see, are things that were created for the sake of creativity rather than created because somebody paid for them to be created.
Exactly.
And I'm getting nods. So, and so the thesis that you have to reward people before they will create things is empirically false. And insofar as that thesis justifies certain policies and practices regarding ownership, copyright, stuff like that, those arguments are similarly undermined. Well, I'm not sure what this is. I'm sure I had a reason for it, though. And we're going to wait for it. Here it comes. Oh, Flash MX for interactive simulation. Right, again, all the Flash tools, the Breeze, the MX, and all of that. And people, there's been, and I'm sure you've seen this proliferation of these Flash animations on the web. It just kills me. You look at how much work's involved in making those, and people make them, and they're utterly pointless. like those Pengo games. Have you seen those Pengo games? The penguin comes sliding down the thing and pops up in the air, and then you have to hit it with a bat. See how it's just totally pointless games that probably took forever to create, and yet the tools are there, people create them, and those are the good ones. There are many more bad ones out there. Okay. Now for the harder part, because see, the trick is, we saw DeviantArt, 15 million artifacts, and similar numbers on Flickr, 10 million blogs or whatever, 100 million blog posts, and then on top of that is all the production of all the commercial media, educational content, museum content, images, scans, and things like that. And then in a person's individual environment will be emails and calendar dates and all of that stuff. And the question becomes, how do you make sense of any of this? How do you deal with this? I mean, way beyond the simple production of it. How do you get a handle on it? Because it used to be simple. It used to be simple because there were a certain limited number of places that you could get media, newspapers. A city might have two, maybe three newspapers. Television, three channels plus UHF, the way it was. But even today, it's only a limited number of channels. We're limited to, what, 500? But it's still pretty limited. It's still nothing on. Radio. And these people would act as filters, right? And everybody would try to, you know, I want to be a movie star. I want to be a television star. And the radio stations, the newspaper editors would pick or hire even those content producers that they thought were the best and most appropriate, and they would be the ones who made it through this filter, and then from the filter there'd be a broadcasting. And so from a single source, you have, you know, one radio station, 50,000 listeners, one TV station, 1 million viewers, whatever. Doesn't work when there's 15 million content producers. You can't have a broadcast mode of delivery anymore, because then you get information overload. The obvious instance of this is spam, because you have 15 million advertisers now too, or one advertiser producing 15 million advertisements. I haven't figured out which it is yet. So what we need is a mechanism that basically amounts to micro-publishing. A mechanism for very finely grained content distribution. Or, as the diagram here says, content syndication. And the mechanism that is generally is the most popularly used on the internet is RSS. You've all heard of RSS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Didn't used to be that. I'd come give a talk, RSS. You know, but now it's RSS. Great, yeah. Or sometimes now RSS. Yeah, but that's so last year. No matter what I say, sooner or later I'm going to hit a rough crowd. There's the principle, and the principle is that you have the content. It is produced by content producers. It's brought together, harvested, or aggregated, and then it's distributed to multiple locations. And sometimes, I mean, this diagram's a bit of a misnomer, because you don't always need that little house there in the middle that brings it all in together. It can actually go straight from producer to where it's being played. But the idea and the principle behind RSS, well, in a sense, it's twofold. In one sense, it's what RSS is trying to do. And what RSS is trying to do is to create a mechanism whereby content produced in one location can be displayed, presented, played, or whatever, in multiple locations. So it's a distribution mechanism. And probably the most clear and evident instance of that is podcasting. Podcasting is the use of RSS in order to distribute audio content. Because lots of people are producing audio, but how do you find audio? I mean, you can't even Google it, right? But what RSS does is that it allows this audio to be put into a content distribution network so that an audio file will reach a set of intended listeners. And right now, and probably for a little while anyways, the set of intended listeners is defined as a list of people who subscribe to a given RSS feed. In other words, subscribers. So you have a producer, and then people who are interested in that producer sign up for or subscribe to that RSS feed. The second part of it, and probably the more important part of it in a certain sense, because syndication is as old as the hills, right? And Plato was syndicating Socrates. That was for you. is that because RSS represents content, audio content in the form of podcasts, text content in the form of blog posts or newspaper articles, because it represents this content in XML, this process of syndication can happen automatically without human intervention. And I'm going to pop in here. Where am I going to go? I didn't want to go there. Well, I'm going to pop in just to pull up a website and go home. And what we... This is a site called EduRSS. And this is a demonstration of what I mean by automatic. Now, I'm sorry, it has to tell. I haven't actually gone into the EduRSS program for months. EduRSS is running right now as we speak. Here's something that came in from Roland Tanglau. Roland's podcast, Mike, the one he recommends. Okay, well, there you go. That came in about an hour and a half ago. There's a bit of a lag, right? And some other stuff. This is all the stuff that came in. I haven't seen any of this because it's been produced while we've been speaking here. That's the stuff that came in now. What EduRSS does is it aggregates or harvests from a set of RSS feeds. And the way I do EduRSS is I pick a set of feeds that are related to topics of my own interest. So e-learning, new media, related technology, syndication, some other things. So each one of these links corresponds to a website and an RSS feed that's out there. Not well formed. Daniel Lemire, your feed is not well formed. Grumble.
Oh, those Daniels, you have to worry about that.
It's funny. I haven't looked at David Davies for a little while. Let's see what David Davies is up to. He is. And so there's now the thing about his feed, it's on his website. He produces this feed once he's done with it for the day. Right? But now his feed is brought in by many, many people. I'm just one of those. So I've brought in this feed, and you can see here, because it's XML, the data is all structured. Here's a resource, the title, the link, the description, and then some lesser fields. Now, the thing is, although it's all in XML, it's a very simple type of XML. You look at this, like here's the RSS for one item. Actually, it goes down a bit. You could do that. You could do that with a text editor. You don't need special software. You don't need permission from Bill Gates, right? You don't need to register for some kind of service. You want to produce RSS, you haul out your text editor, you can type in your comment, you are part of the publishing community. That was it. Hey, you probably won't get paid for it, but we've already covered that, right? So, now, most people don't use a plain text editor for RSS, but the point is they could. And even if they use a tool like an RSS generator, they can still go in and edit their RSS file to taste after the tool has produced whatever it is. So it's a very accessible type of XML. So anyhow, I harvest David Davies' stuff and so on, all the rest of these guys. I bring it into EduRSS, and basically what I do is I take their stuff, I clip it down to 600 characters because I'm not made of disk space, and I store it into a database. But now, that's the beginning. Now, the neat thing is, right, this is one output, which is the most recent RSS post. But what I've done, and what anybody can do, really, is I take all of this content, and it is structured content, so I can know what's, you know, what part's what, and I organize it into topics. Here are my topic listings. And so content syndication, course modules, etc. Any of these things that I want. Google is a topic. And so here is the output feed from EduRSS on Google. And as you can see, what I've done, the top link is Education Technology from Tim Lauer from yesterday morning to be precise, and Techno News Blog. Google just released the blog search site, so I'm going to get a cluster of these hits, right? Very. Think about how focused this is, right? This is sites or posts about Google authored by people who work in the field of educational technology or related industries. Very focused, very precise. If you're in this field and you signed up to this feed, you are getting only stuff that's directly relevant to you. Now, the neat thing here is this works completely automatically. I do nothing to make this work. All I did, I wrote the code, but I mean, other than that, because, you know, now you could get the code and do this yourself, right? And actually, this basic code isn't that hard to write. But
so us will do it. Thank you.
But the thing that I, the main thing that I did is I picked the sites that I want to harvest, right, to make sure I'm getting good quality input, and then I defined the categories. And actually, the way I defined the categories, I'm going into the old site here, so I have to type. I'm right in the middle of a transition, which is makes things a bit trickier to show. This is the hacking that somebody did a couple of years ago, and I left it there. I didn't like that. Here are my categories. And basically, we go into, where's Google? Oh, well, it doesn't matter, I'll just pick one. I want to pick a good one, because you can't really tell otherwise. Here we go, this will be a good one. Yeah. Here's the category, Philadelphia. And it's a category because there's a certain cluster of concepts that all kind of center around Philadelphia. So I've given the category a name, Philadelphia, and now this is the definition of the category. And what you'll notice is it's a set of strings and then some delimiters. That vertical pipe in regular expressions is the OR. So basically, anything with Philadelphia or Pennsylvania or Penn State will end up as being selected by this category of Philadelphia. I use regular expressions to define categories because the attitude that I take toward categories is that they are predefined searches. And so I use a regular expression to define the search. I could use SQL just as well. I could use keywords just as well, but my experience is that regular expressions give me a flexibility of expression that keywords and SQL do not, and so that's why I use them. But I'm not locked into using them. This approach contrasts to two other approaches that are widely in use on the internet. One other approach is structured data or categorized data, where the content entities are placed into categories in a taxonomy. And I looked at that and I thought, who has the time? I already have like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of resources in EduRSS, and I get hundreds every day. There's not a chance in the world that I'm going to categorize them in any sort of way. And more to the point, I could not categorize them in a manner that could be reasonably be expected to be useful to the majority of my readers, because a taxonomy, any taxonomy, is a way of looking at the world. It's a perspective. It's a point of view. It's a context. And as we talked about earlier before the break, your context, your way of looking at the world is different from mine. It's like when you tried to use Google. You remember, or not Google, Yahoo. You remember Yahoo when they first started They actually did that. They used subject hierarchies in order to organize it. To use Yahoo, you had to go to Yahoo. Okay, how would a Yahoo engineer categorize this? Because, you know, you can't use what you would think because there's no way. They're just, the categories were like a mile long, eight, ten different layers of categorization. Hierarchical classification schemes work on a limited set of entities. Beyond that limited set of entities, and it becomes impossible for an untrained or uninitiated searcher to navigate that hierarchy. So that was out. It was never on. The other approach, and it's a lot of people have talked about it recently, is tagging. I'm sure. And what tagging consists of is you have a resource, a blog post, an image, whatever, and then the people who go view that blog post type in a tag in a field. Usually the creator is the person who does that, but typically when they see it, they'll type in a tag. And so it's sort of like community-based keyword generation with no scheme or canonical vocabulary. I like tagging because, in a sense, because tagging adds to the data that is associated with the object. But for blog posts, and particularly blog posts in EduRSS, from my perspective, tagging isn't adding information that I need because I already have the blog post. So all the words associated with that blog post, well, not all, but the major key ones, are already in the post. So adding more words can be a bit useful, but certainly would not replace the post. Now, the story is very different with images, which do not have textual content. Although with images, I think that people should be typing in descriptions rather than single words. Again, because you're getting something better than tags. The main thing for tagging, though, is I've got EduRSS running. EduRSS is bringing in 100, 200 items a day. And let's suppose I was tagging these, right? Let's suppose even that I had the time to tag each one of these items. Or even let's say I had the people who subscribe to EduRSS doing this. I may actually do that anyways. It's probably a good idea. But the thing is, what happens is concepts, memes, whatever, they kind of rise. They don't suddenly appear, but they kind of sneak up on you. Like podcasting, for example, first came into being in properly so-called in August of 2003. But most people didn't think to start tagging things under the heading of podcasting until like November, December, January. Well, now by the time it's November, December, January, there's all this content that should have been tagged podcasting but wasn't. Well, now what do you do? Because now your podcasting tag doesn't reach back into the history of podcasting. But when I do podcasting, let's see if I can't find this. I'm pretty sure I have a podcasting tag. I might not be able to find it. Oh yeah, there it is. Oops. Yeah. When I do podcasting, well, when I should have a better definition, but I'll do something like this: MP3, right? iPod. I don't know what else was that. Right. So basically what I'm doing there is I'm creating the set of associated concepts that actually constitutes the concept of podcasting, and indeed my system will reach back into the history of podcasting even before the term podcasting was used to collect associated resources. So that's why I take the approach that I do on this. Now, all of this, so we've got all of these topics, and Stephanie Porto, actually, I eventually got email from, actually, Stefan Porta. He said, I had nothing to do with this. It was someone else, anyhow. So I had a nice conversation with the real Stefan Porta. And that's why you sometimes leave these things in, because you never know what the result will be. Now, what I do is I turn around and I take any one of these things and, in turn, offer it as an RSS feed. So now, what I want you to picture in your mind, because I don't have, well, I don't, not in this presentation anyways, what we've got here now. Okay, what we've got is a layer of input. All the people creating their own individual blog posts. And then there's the harvesting thing that happens and the organization. And now we have a layer of feeds based on the collection of those inputs. So there's a layer, whole bunch of connection, another layer, and then there'll be the readers of all of this, whole bunch of connection, another layer of readers. And so we've got layer after layer of densely connected nodes of content. And that's the structure of the network that's created by the automatic harvesting and organization of metadata. It is my proposition, the thesis that I'm advancing, that this structure, when sufficiently widely used, that is to say, when there's more than one instance of EduRSS, when there's a sufficient number of people reading and feeding forward the results of this kind of filtering, this kind of structure will self-organize. That is to say, that you can pick an output point of this structure such that the organization of the network itself, rather than any intervention, rather than any management of it, will result in an output that is appropriate to your needs and interests. And the ground, the evidence I have for that is that we know generically that networks of this type, of this construction, do self-organize. We have plenty of evidence for that. We have mathematical evidence. We have evidence in the form of social network analysis. We have evidence in the computational or computer science theory of connectionism. And we have evidence from people who look at the structure of brains and neurophysics. It's an empirical thesis, which means it could be proven false. But all the evidence that I've seen points to it's probably going to be proven true. Because even with the connectivity that we have on the internet today, we already see the dynamics that we see in social networks. We already see power laws. We already see clustering and interest groups and communities of practice self-organized, springing into being on their own. And so it's reasonable to expect that content entities such as blog posts will self-organize in a similar way. And if not, we still have this great distribution network and we'll just tweak it because we're people, we tweak things.
Just to give you an order of time, we have allowed until 3 o'clock for this presentation to go on, and after at 3, we will do the interview with Julie.
Okay. I thought it was 2:45 we were finishing.
Oh, 2:45 is good, too.
And I've covered one slide in that time. Good job, Steve. Well, that's okay, because that, to a large degree, was the core of it. It does kind of bounce around a bit. In e-learning proper, the direction a lot of this stuff is taking is the direction of e-portfolios. And e-portfolios right now is a single term being used to refer to a fairly broad array of approaches. And also the application of e-portfolios is varying depending on which domain you're in. There are two major approaches for e-portfolios. The first place is a space or a place, if you will, in order to present or display your own created material. An e-portfolio, properly thought of, would be a place where you have RSS feeds or display RSS feeds for the content that you posted on Flickr, the blog posts that you put in Blogger, the messages that you input on a say Yahoo groups, the audio that you've uploaded to iPod or whatever. So in other words, it's a place where you display your own work. And in North America especially, that's morphed a little bit to being also interpreted as a place where your instructor can evaluate the work that you've done. So instead of doing a test, you know, because online multiple choice tests are kind of squiffy, instead of writing essays, you have your e-portfolio, and your e-portfolio is used in order to determine your grade. And me, I'm not big on assessment anyways. I've been asked about assessment every once in a while. What's your favorite model of assessment? And only half jokingly, I say, well, I think people should be assessed not by instructors, but by the wider community. And not by any set of criteria, but by random and probably unfair criteria. And because that's how the rest of their life works. I don't know. I am not going to hang my researcher hat on that theory of assessment. But neither would I hang my hat on you should be assessed by a professor who's working at 2 in the morning after 5 beers marking your final paper worth 60%. Right? Maybe there's a middle ground there. Yeah, if you're the buyer of the beer, then it's a great theory.
But what do you think, Stephen, about the students assessing themselves? And then
we don't have enough room for that many A's. No,
but
I'm just kidding.
They have to debate and they have to prove why they have the A. And maybe this conversation with the teacher would allow them to keep the A or not.
Well, I've never done as well as I did if I was grading myself. I think
a lot of people really judge themselves more harshly than even their harshest critics. I mean, personal self-confidence is a huge issue in society and in schools, in my view. I mean, and you can test that. Go someplace, go to a school, go to the mall, whatever, and compliment people, right? And look at their reactions, right? And some people go, oh, thank you. And other people say, well, that's not my best. And you see the range of reactions, right? And people, even when you're telling them they did a good job, they're going, no, it's not true. So.
But at the same time, it is, if you want student-centered, they take the responsibility. A great part of that responsibility. Mm-hmm. Because you know, at the end of the day, you're always competing with yourself.
Sure.
And start them young.
You see, I wonder, I think of assessment as a proxy for evidence that you can actually do something. Sometimes you need that proxy, right? You want somebody to have a good score on piloting aircraft before you actually let them pilot an aircraft, because the proof that they can't do it is unfortunately fatal. But, more and more, particularly in a computational and connected environment, we don't need that proxy anymore. What is the proof that I'm a good philosopher? It's in the philosophizing, right? It's not, can I answer 10 questions on John Stuart Mill? Yes, I can, by the way. But it's not that, right? It's not, can I write a good essay on John Stuart Mill, right? Or in the sense that the essay that I wrote on John Stuart Mill is in itself the proof. The grade is to a large degree meaningless. What's the proof that you could pilot and land successfully a 747? Well, yeah, obviously doing it in a 747, but more and more doing it in the simulator is good evidence that you could do it in the actual plane. And given that the things are worth $500 million, the first time you put a pilot in a 747 and land it, you're already taking a pretty big risk, even if there's no passengers. So they do take successful performance in the simulation as sufficient, and indeed would never take the proxy. Would you put a person in charge of a 747 if they successfully passed a 100-question multiple choice test on how to land the 747? Not a chance, right? So my view of assessment is, for the most part, it's a proxy. It's a bad proxy, mostly, and it's this intermediary that, for the most part, is not necessary. People talk about credentials and that. I say, my website, that's my credential, right? Degrees, whatever, irrelevant. Now, of course, society being what it is, they're not irrelevant. I am not qualified to teach or to work in a university because I don't have the credentials, right? Most of them, but not all of them. So that, you know, they wouldn't let me do that. Although I think I probably could. And when I make the claim that I probably could, I point to the body of work that I've produced over the years on my website and say, that's my credential. This talk is my credential. And indeed, imagine me trying to pull this off by plagiarizing or cheating or whatever. I've got live audio here, right? You can't pull it off. It's genuine. So, portfolios for evaluation. I think that the portfolio itself will be the evaluation over time. If these are sufficiently widely used, and the grade that an instructor assigns to it will be superfluous. Why would you need that? It's just one person's opinion, and probably, or maybe even not even a person that liked the person who was being evaluated, or maybe a person that liked that person too much. You know, you can't tell. Or maybe a person that's had five beers. Who knows? But you see the work directly, and that becomes your metric for evaluation. That's my view, anyways. I know, I'm at...
No, you're good. You're, until 3.
Oh, right, yeah, I keep thinking 2:40. Well, I hope to sneak in a short break. But the model... Now, again, we're sort of at this picture, right? And again, picture in your mind the kind of framework that we're looking at. We've got applications distributed all over the internet that communicate with each other using RSS and variants of RSS as a communications medium, which means that most of this dialogue, at least at the computational level, can happen automatically so that we don't always need to be managing this stuff. Where there's a sphere or a layer of consistent identity that rides through this collection of applications. That's the picture. And that picture is sort of being solidified in what's called the e-learning framework. And there's supposed to be a picture there. Oops, that's not it. There it is. I don't know why. It's not that. Every time I click on this thing, it changes screens. The e-learning framework, I put it under the heading of JISC, although Industry Canada is involved in this, along with other agencies from the United States and Australia. Basically, what the e-learning framework defines are services, agents, and other applications that play particular roles in this cloud of interrelated applications. And so we see sample user agents, like, you know, assignment marking tool. Well, okay, that probably won't be that useful. But, you know, library system, timetabling, learning domain services like competency, marking, reporting, tracking. And then each one of these is defined as one or more canonical applications, but more importantly, one or more application programming interfaces or data definitions protocol languages. In other words, there's a way for applications within this domain to work with and communicate with other applications within this domain and also applications elsewhere in the framework. For example, a timetabling application will expose its data in such a way that other applications being used by the same person can reach into the timetabling application and get information about, say, what they're doing tomorrow, or whatever else you'd need timetabling information for. Now, all of this whole e-learning framework is fairly new, is very fluid. Right now it's kind of loosely defined, and it's not clear exactly how the specific JISC e-learning framework project is going to go. And I think that we're actually going to have multiple simultaneous instances of the same approach. And you're going to get the formally defined, high overhead, Java-based, syntax-heavy kind of approach, which would be characteristic of these large enterprise systems, even though they're sort of all sort of separate systems. And then you're going to get the RSS version, where it's kind of like all held together with binder twine, where if there's a protocol, it consists of three elements and then maybe another element or two that lots of people use, but you don't really have to. There are applications that are used, but they're not applications that were used or designed specifically for e-learning. It's just they work really well for it. Like Audacity works really well for creating audio, but they didn't create Audacity for e-learning. It's not an e-learning application. It's just an application. Like Skype. Skype wasn't created for e-learning, but it could fit into a loosely, roughly designed framework as a good communication tool. So I think we'll see the formal definition, but I think we'll use the informal equivalent of it. If you're MIT, you can buy this whole big formal version, but if you're Joe College, it's Blogger, Skype, Wikipedia, and ICQ, and that's the way you're going. That's my take on this. Anyways, the main concept here is all of these different applications interacting with each other, and then over and above that, riding above that, sort of like the virtual student application, which really just is a set of consistent information that's accessible across different applications. My own theory, and I think you can do all of this with RSS. And that's what I'm up to. This is my current system. It still has lots of problems because I'm just converting it over. But the idea here is that all of these different data types, posts, galleries, calendars, all of those sorts of things can be expressed basically with RSS and then one or two extended fields. Take a calendar entry, for example. What is a calendar entry? A scheduled appointment or something like that. It's a title, maybe, seminar at Canadian Heritage. It's a URL, a location, which is where my slides would be. And it's a description, the abstract. And then that's the basic RSS plus three fields. Start time, end time, which I guess we left undefined here, and location. And there's your calendar entry. And a lot of these things, a journal, an organization, a person, a lot of these things can be defined with this very simple XML format. Now the key, and this is the part that the community's only just now beginning to get, which they sort of got in the semantic web, except they layered this huge syntactical overhead onto it so nobody could understand it, is that these entities, calendar events, PowerPoint slides, people, organizations, can all be related to each other. And that the definition of one of these entities can and should include a reference to the definition of another one of these entities. So that's what I'm trying to build here. And so, for example, I have a post. I'm just trying to think of a fast way to show this. I have a post. Oh, actually, you won't see it that way. What's the easy way to do it? Yeah, at this point. Alright, so here's a post. Oops, that's a comment. I want to use one of my posts because it's a bit easier. I use the same thing. Comment is the same thing as a blog post, is the same thing as a whatever, an article. So I'm just trying to find one that I've done. Here we go. Alright. So that's a post. That's something that I wrote on my website. But my post actually has a reference. And unfortunately, I can't just click on that. It's going to go, oh, how do I define that? Oh, here we go. I'll do it this way. Post, here we go. Post, 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 full. Sorry, I don't read well. Now, this is a display definition for the post on my site. And the post itself is associated with an item that's out there on the internet. So, here's the description that I wrote in here somewhere. There it is, right? But I'm actually referring via a reference to the item itself. The item itself is a distinct entity. So I've got two entities on the go now. I've got my commentary and the distinct entity, which is an item. And I associate those with a reference. For those of you who understand databases, a reference is very much like a lookup table or a link list connecting external posts or external items with internal posts created by me. If I go to the definition of one of those items, link, an item out there in the world will have its own description or whatever, but it will have an author. And the author, again, is associated with the item by means of a reference or a lookup. So now I've got, for my one post, the post that you saw, I've got three distinct entities on the go now, right? I've got my post, I've got the external artifact, the post that was on somebody else's thing, and then I have the author. And also, I won't go through it, but I also have the publication or journal in which that's located. I also have the publisher that produced the journal, the organization, and user ratings, and so on. You can see the categories I've come up with so far, and there are more. And the idea is that these distinct types of entities are all related to each other. And what I'm trying to do with my system is, when data comes into the system, either by me typing it or by me harvesting the RSS feed, it looks at this data and it extracts from this information about an organization, information about a publication, and it stores these in the different places and then draws the relations together. And the reason why I do that is because, for example, now, here's my list of authors, and I can very easily, I guess it's just one thing here, right? Very easily display all the items written by this particular author. And on my system, I'll get your classic power law, right? Most of my authors on my system have written one item. With you know, but so I'll find somebody who's written more. You'll see more things, but I don't know if I can find.
But
someone.
The idea is very interesting. It's just the principle.
Yeah, but the thing is, okay. Now, the idea, the idea itself is in a strict sense as old as the hills, because this is how databases are designed. And so the difference between what I'm doing and databases is that the entire internet is my database, right? Because the XML that describes one of these resources is over there on the resource author's site. The XML that describes a person is on that person's website. The XML that describes an organization is on the organization website. So the actual data is distributed. And if the data is created in such a way that these links are explicit somewhere, then when we harvest it, we can harvest not only the content, but also the structure of the content. That's what I'm up to. That's like future. That's down the road. The internet at large, the web development, the people who are working on Web 2.0 are just beginning to tap into this. If you look at a concept called microformats, there's a website, microformats.org, you'll see work now being devoted to defining, at least at the XHTML layer, the mechanisms for defining these kind of types so that we can pull or extract or harvest this data from the context in which it's located and begin to create this richer data based on harvesting. And we're also going to see this more within XML as well. In XML proper, there's already hundreds of different XML formats. What is going to happen, though, is people are going to realize sooner or later that what we didn't need hundreds of different XML formats. What we needed was something really simple like RSS or Dublin Core that we can then customize slightly for a particular application. So we'll have XML micro formats, that little bit of stuff that you add to RSS to take something and make it a calendar entry, or to take something and make it a comment or an article or whatever. And I think that's the direction in which we're headed. There's some of this is already evident in Atom. Atom is sort of like a modern version of RSS. We're already beginning to see in Atom some optional link elements that you can add to indicate some of the structure that I was talking about. But it's very early days for this. In 5 years, it'll be all over. It'll be like RSS is now, like blogs are now. But it's going to take that range of time because people need to build these applications. But more significantly, they need to wrap their mind around the concept of distributed data, distributed metadata. And that's not there yet. So that's very much looking forward.
Thank you very much. Stephen. You've been very generous with your ideas. I think you're saying things now that we're thinking about, and it's like getting the answer. This is wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for giving us so much of your time.
To abuse of your time. And give you a little break before Julie's interview.
Sure.
So, any questions, colleagues?
Before? I'm still trying to absorb that. Fascinating.
It's neat stuff, and it's hard. I mean,
yeah,
it's cool though. I like the concept of this really kind of like, simplifying tagging structure to describe basically all web resources, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of somehow trying to figure out a way to like easily describe these without describing them with 100 different tags.
Yeah,
being able to kind of see them and basically look at everything as kind of like an internet resource.
Right.
URL, really.
Yeah, that's how I view the world. I view the world as a bunch of similar resources with slightly different tags and a location.
Thank you so much. I think 2 days would have been just enough. You can always come back, as you said.
I can always come back. I am online.
Yes.
You can all read my newsletter. And in reading my newsletter, because I have switched over to this new system now, you can watch as I put this thing together and enjoy all the software bugs along with me. And so far there have been quite a few, but that's the nature of it. And people who read my stuff have come to expect that the software that supports it is not going to be perfect. And some days they'll get no email newsletters, and other days they'll get 500. Well, okay, not that bad.
Thank you very much. And so maybe
thanks a lot.
We will bring you to the other room.
Sure.
Have settled the other room, and we'll come back here at the end. Okay. You have a busy sitting
part. Bye, online people.
Yes,
thank you.
Thank you.
Here we go.
Thank you.